I'm Gail Harris. Robin Young is off today. It's Here and Now. Newsweek magazine calls it Bush's big bounce, with a new poll showing an 11-point lead over Democratic challenger John Kerry. Two others, the Rasmussen and Zogby polls, show the two candidates still within 3 points of each other, a statistical tie. Even before these poll numbers came out, the Kerry camp began rethinking its strategy and hiring some big names from the Clinton administration shortly after Kerry's lengthy phone conversation with former President Bill Clinton on Saturday. Well, joining us on the line from New York is Marcus Mabry, senior editor for Newsweek magazine. Hi, Marcus.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. So tell us more about this poll. You know, Bush gets the bounce after his convention. Kerry did not. What were some of the buzzwords that voters seemed to be latching onto after the Republican convention?
I think it was basically the issues of flip-flopping. It was the issue of resolute leadership with regards to George Bush. And I think withering attacks on John Kerry over 4 nights and that constant bolstering of the president really had an impact on voters. It does come as a bit of a surprise that it's such a healthy bounce, and it's normal by historical standards, but in this very tight election, it actually looks quite impressive relative to Kerry's mini-bounce.
Well, and remind us, historically, what does happen to an incumbent around Labor Day? Is this not unexpected that an incumbent who can get his message out there with the help of a lot of TV ads does get some bolstering around now?
Well, it depends. I mean, what Karl Rove did was it was brilliant to use. This is the latest we've ever had a convention, and to have a nominating convention really, you know, the week right before Labor Day, leading right into the Labor Day weekend. What that means is traditionally, historically, whoever's ahead on Labor Day wins. That's political conventional wisdom. Well, of course, if you're still experiencing your convention bounce, then that means you'll be ahead on Labor Day. And that could be really, really smart on Karl Rove's part, because we in the media may start to say now, can John Kerry survive? Now, if we do that, I think, number one, it's a mistake, because the reason we call this a convention bounce is because, you know, like any bounce, it goes up, but it also goes down. This bounce will dissipate. That always happens historically. There's a stronger feeling for the candidate immediately after his convention than there will be a week to 10 days later. However, and I think this is, again, Karl Rove's brilliance, is if the media starts to say, while we're in the illusion of this bounce, it's kind of a bubble, if you will, that John Kerry is finished, well, that could create a self-sustaining momentum that could carry through at least most of the remaining time of the campaign. And that's exactly what the Bushes hope will happen.
Sure, although the conventional wisdom also said about a year ago this time that Kerry was finished then.
That's right, and I think that's exactly what the Kerry people will latch on to, that and technical changes such as enlarging their leadership circle among Kerry's political aides to include Clinton's brain trust and the people who, you know, have brought us the only successful and reelected Democrat in a generation and a half. So I think it'll be interesting to see both the changes in the technical aspects of the campaign that the Clinton people will bring to John Kerry. And I think, secondly, John Kerry historically has been known as a great closer, and I think no one knows that more than the voters of Massachusetts. When you write him off, when you think he's down and done, it's really kind of, you know, in World Series lingo, he's Mr. October. That's when he'll come back. And so I think that's what the Kerry people will be hoping to see again, but they have a lot of work to do between now and November 2nd.
Well, of course, it's not over till it's over. The next big event is the first presidential debate that'll be happening on September 30th. Thank you so much, Marcus.
Thank you.
Marcus Mabry is senior editor at Newsweek magazine. With all of us getting older every day, the question on many people's minds this Labor Day is, what will happen to me once I retire? There have been several highly publicized cases of pension funds that are in trouble in corporate America. Bridget Madrian, professor of business and public policy at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, joins us for more on what's ahead for retiring workers. Welcome, Bridget.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with the big picture first. What is happening these days with the pension plans that large companies offered in the past?
Well, the typical defined benefit pension plan that many large companies offered for many decades is still offered to many employees, but the number of employers offering these plans has been declining steadily for the past 20 years, so that today most workers who are covered by a pension plan are actually covered by a 401k-style pension plan, not a traditional defined benefit plan.
So now what would happen to many of these workers who were counting on a defined pension plan for their retirement?
This has gotten a lot of attention in the media lately, with United Airlines and other large companies facing financial troubles and possibly liquidating their pension plan. So there is some risk associated with these plans, in particular risk that the company itself will go bankrupt or be unable to meet its promised pension obligations. And this is one reason why, among others, why companies are moving away from offering these types of pension plans.
Well, if these companies get into trouble and are not able to guarantee their pension plans for workers, is there anyone else the workers can turn to? Can the government bail them out?
So the answer is yes and no. So defined benefit pension plans are insured by the federal government through the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, but the insurance is not complete. The PBGC only insures pension benefits up to a certain level, and right now that's somewhere between $44,000 and $45,000 a year. So if you are a highly paid employee, so for example, the pilots at United Airlines and the PBGC takes over the pension plan, you're probably looking at a significant reduction in your pension benefits. You will get something, but it's not nearly what you would have been anticipating.
Are the airlines, though, something of a canary in a coal mine here? Are they the first of what could be many?
Well, they're actually not the first. We went through a similar situation 2 or 3 years ago with a number of large steel companies. So this is a problem that's been looming on the horizon, and people in the industry have known about it. But the airlines are certainly not the last industry that's going to find itself in these circumstances.
Well, now, President Bush has proposed privatizing Social Security benefits so that as individuals, we are more responsible for our own investments and our own retirement. Is that an answer?
Well, there are pros and cons to privatizing Social Security. The outcomes are only going to be as good as the decisions that the workers make about how to invest mm-hmm. those assets. And there's a lot of evidence that many workers are not very financially sophisticated, aren't particularly comfortable making investment decisions, and in fact tend to make fairly poor investment decisions.
Well, bottom line then, are American workers really protected when we retire?
Well, there is no fail-safe guarantee for retirement. There are certainly prudent things you can do, and I think the important thing for workers to realize is that with any type of retirement system, whether it be a 401k plan, and we saw the problems there with Enron, or a defined benefit pension, and we're seeing the problems there with United Airlines, or with Social Security, there are risks associated with all of these various types of retirement income security vehicles, and individuals should be aware of what those risks are, and they need to make financial decisions on their own that help mitigate or offset some of those risks.
Bridget Madrian is a professor of business and public policy at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. She spoke to us from her home in Philadelphia. Well, the airlines are getting many of the headlines these days, starting with United Airlines stopping payments to its pension plan this summer. But what does this mean on a personal level? Tom Lanza is a lead inspector for U.S. Airways in Pittsburgh. He began there as a mechanic when he was 19 years old, during the golden age of the airline industry. But now, after 38 years of service, he's wondering what will happen to him during his golden years. Tom, welcome.
Hey, how you doing, Gail?
Very well, thanks. Can you tell us a little bit about the kind of work you do and how that's changed over the years?
Well, I started out as a mechanic, and I am now a lead inspector. I have a group of inspectors under me that inspect the aircraft when they come in for heavy maintenance.
So you make sure that the planes are ready to fly again as soon as they come in?
Yes.
And what does that mean? I mean, does that mean that you have to know every functioning part of an airplane or what?
Well, you need to know, you have to have a great knowledge of all the systems of the aircraft. Also, it involves a lot of metal work, and then you have the all the FAA regulations that you have to comply with.
Tom, do you mind if I ask about how much you're making right now?
Well, we're making just under $60,000 a year as a lead inspector. The mechanics make a bit less than that.
What would happen if you were to say, okay, that's it, I've had it, I'm going to retire right now?
If I were to retire right now, my retirement is still intact, and I would receive about $2,500 a month. But if the company would become insolvent, even after I retire, my retirement would go down to about $1,600 a month. So you feel like you've been cheated because you've been told if you work for us 40 hours a week, this is your pension. And now when the pension time comes around, it may not be there.
So how does that make you feel about your work and about the company?
The whole big picture is wrong. Pensions should be 100% funded as you go through the years, and when you're, regardless of what happens at the end, it should be there for you.
Tom, can you tell me a little bit about what you and some of the other people you work with are doing now to try and supplement your income?
Well, everybody in this organization has a plan B. You know, things aren't looking real good, and we don't know from day to day what's going to happen. So everybody has something that they're looking to fall back on. Mine is home improvements. I would probably go out and test my skills trying to make a living at doing home improvements.
Not what you had in mind for your golden years.
Exactly. You know, you have to keep pushing to pay the bills and just hope for the best.
I understand you've raised six children of your own.
Yeah, I have six daughters and put all six of them through college. And, of course, that takes a toll. And you have to continue to pay those bills, you know, and far into my golden years, I guess you'd say.
Hmm. Well, what's your advice to your daughters and to your sons-in-law, if you have some?
Save your money. Don't depend on anything, including Social Security, you know, because that's another thing we look at and say, well, that'll be there when I'm ready for it. But you never know. It may not be.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us.
Well, thanks for calling, Gail.
Tom Lanza is a lead inspector for U.S. Airways. He spoke to us from his home in Pittsburgh. Just ahead, a new documentary examines the battle between the designers of the Freedom Tower and other buildings to be built on the site of the former World Trade Center in New York. And a little later, a look at the head of the organization responsible for the 9/11 terror attacks. We'll talk with the author of Osama. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Gail Harris. It's Here and Now. After 9/11, there was great determination to not just fill, but somehow heal the gaping hole left behind at Ground Zero. An international design competition for the former World Trade Center site chose architect Daniel Liebeskind. His design included a tower 1,776 feet tall, with a spire to echo the torch held aloft by the Statue of Liberty. At least, that was the plan. A new Frontline documentary, Sacred Ground, shows how politics, ego, and the almighty dollar all play a role in what will eventually be built on the site of the former Twin Towers. Last week, Jennifer Westaway spoke with the documentary director, Kevin Sim.
Let's start just to lay this out for listeners from a kind of key fact. The developer, Larry Silverstein, tell us about his relationship to the World Trade Center.
Larry Silverstein is a great New York success story. One day, he signed a check for, I think, $3.2 billion and bought a 99-year lease on the World Trade Center. That was on the 24th of July, 2001. So it was just 6 weeks before 9/11.
We saw an opportunity to significantly enhance the value of the properties. It was really the culminating transaction of my business career.
And along with the lease and the obligation to rebuild came the right, as it were, to appoint the architect. And he did. He appointed his own architect. And the irony of it is that he'd appointed an architect before the competition was even thought of, and the architect was working on his own plans privately.
The difficulty is that the developer, Larry Silverstein, was not the only one who had ideas for the site. There was an architect chosen to put something where Ground Zero was. What happened with these competing visions of what should be done?
Well, the result was you had two very, very different architects, both of whom had a claim to a sense of ownership of how the site was going to look. I mean, Larry Silverstein's architect, it was a chap called David Childs, an immensely experienced architect who'd built an extraordinary number of really prominent high-rise buildings all over the world. By comparison, Daniel is a kind of stranger in a way. Although he was brought up in the Bronx after he emigrated to America when he was 14 and was educated and became an architect in New York, but he hasn't got so much experience of actually building buildings. The biggest building that Daniel built was the Jewish Museum in Berlin, which is absolutely fascinating building and actually put him in the constellation of the greatest of the world's architects at the present time. But it's not a very big building. So you have two very, very, very different architects with two very, very different ideas of what a skyscraper should be.
Well, what was the role of the governor of New York in all of this? Because you have two architects with very different visions. Someone has to design the site and the building. What role did he play?
Well, I mean, Pataki recognized very early on that public opinion would not allow business as usual at Ground Zero. They wanted something special there. They wanted something extraordinary. They didn't want it to be replaced by an anonymous office block. And Pataki, in a way, understood that that was his constituency and that really there should be public control of this site. That's why there was a kind of public competition where there could be so much public participation. But how much Larry Silverstein went along with this is less clear, and it's not clear that he was very happy with any of the finalists in the competition.
Well, it looks from the documentary like the governor's solution to this was to try to get the two architects to collaborate, but what your documentary makes abundantly clear was that neither of them seemed able to really do that.
It was a great mistake to try. I mean, there are a lot of examples of architects collaborating, but they have something in common to begin with. I mean, both thought they had the kind of moral right to rebuild Ground Zero.
I have to say, watching this documentary made me absolutely furious. Was that your intent?
I don't think that was my intent to make you furious, no. I mean, what seemed to me to be probable from the beginning was that you have a kind of impossible dream. There is this impossible contest. You have to build a building that represents the soul of America. And you have to build it on a 16-acre site that's just a block away from Wall Street. So you have absolutely the competing interests of normal business and the aspirations of people that want to do something very special because of what had happened there.
When we watch this documentary, you return to the chair of the Ground Zero Committee, Roland Betts, and he has some pretty outspoken things to say about the behavior of those involved. I'd like to play some tape from your documentary. This is Roland Betts.
I thought people would behave better, too. They'd behave like assholes, okay? I wish I had stayed in there and been a referee in the active sense of chairing the meetings and basically saying to David Childs, stop it. Grow up.
On that larger question, Kevin, that people didn't behave as well as expected, is that a fair comment, do you think?
I think that everybody was well-intentioned in this. And there was a lot of passion. And, when you have a group of well-intentioned people, all of whom are, in a sense, used to having their own way, they're not actually going to agree. It wasn't a fairy tale ending.
You were quite sparing in your use of people who lost loved ones in the towers. Tell me why you wanted to have those people in the piece.
From the beginning, I thought that everybody, in a sense, was acting against the backdrop of 9/11. And the continuing backdrop of 9/11 is represented in some ways by the people who actually lost loved ones and whose lives were changed forever by it. And there is a sense in which, however dramatic, however melodramatic, the events that we show in the film with the building of the Freedom Tower are, there is a sense in which the touchstone is going to be the people who are getting it over it in their own way. You know, public rhetoric, which sought to embrace these people, kind of missed the point in some respects. These people, you know, they have to get over it in their own way, each in their own way. And I thought that that kind of contrast put the larger story in a kind of perspective.
Director Kevin Sims speaking with Jennifer Westaway. Sacred Ground airs tomorrow night on PBS stations around the country. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Gail Harris. It's Here and Now. It's been noted that President Bush hasn't publicly uttered the name of Osama bin Laden in about 2 years. Well, Jonathan Randall, 40 years a Mideast correspondent for The Washington Post, has spent much of the last decade trying to meet Osama bin Laden. He failed in that attempt, but he scoured the world bin Laden grew up in and the wars that made him. His new book is called, simply, Osama. Jonathan spoke to Robin Young about his book in the studio.
Is it true, as some have said, that President Bush has not even mentioned Osama bin Laden's name in perhaps 2 years?
That would seem to be the case. As soon as the American troops did not get Osama in late 2001, early 2002, Osama disappeared from the White House vocabulary.
Osama bin forgotten, some say his name is now, but obviously very much on your mind. What was the most interesting thing, to start with, that you discovered about Osama bin Laden that maybe we don't know?
I think the most interesting thing was his family. Most people in the world, and certainly most Saudis and most Americans, think of Osama as the quintessential Saudi merchant prince, where in fact the Saudi government took his citizenship away, blocked his money, and they would never have dared do that to a native-born, real, quote-unquote, Saudi. The fact is, his father was an immigrant from the Hadramaut, which is a very poor part of a very poor country called Yemen, which lies to the south of Saudi Arabia. Father, two brothers, walked for 1,000 miles, got to Jeddah, worked hard, and Osama's father became one of the most prominent men in the kingdom. But he was never a real Saudi, and his mother, in some eyes, is not even a legitimate Muslim. Mm. By that, I mean, she's an Alawite. The Alawites are a sect, live in the mountains along the Mediterranean Sea in Syria. And she was a very beautiful woman. Osama's father liked pretty ladies, had many wives. But the fact is that the Alawites, in the eyes of the Wahhabi, true blue Sunni Muslims of Saudi Arabia, are not the real thing.
Well, the other factor that informing Osama bin Laden that we know of course, is his role in fighting the Soviets in Afghanistan, a member of the Mujahideen. How did that impact him? How did that shape him? And how did that make him, you know, larger than life in the eyes of many Saudis?
In the beginning, he was simply raising money. In the beginning, he went out to see a man named Azam, with whom he worked and later all but replaced. And he was so valuable. He was such a prominent person. He came from such a prized family in Saudi Arabia that he wasn't allowed to get anywhere near Afghanistan. Nowhere. so that it took him a long time to get up to speed. The other thing is, Saudi Arabia is an odd country. All countries are odd, you might say. But this is a country that, since the death of the man who founded it, King Ibn Saud, was hungry for a hero. And all of a sudden, the jihad was right. It allowed Saudis to believe in something beyond their shores, to believe in their religion. And for Osama, this was a way of becoming an instant hero. And the Saudi press went along with it. They were hungry to have one of their own being a superhero. And the Saudi press made him into one very quickly. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying he didn't deserve it, but perhaps the feat of arms that he keeps talking about were less exceptional than a more judicious observer would credit him.
One part of the story that you tell that I found fascinating and didn't feel I knew as much about was when Osama bin Laden returned from Afghanistan, a hero in the eyes of many, he predicted that Saddam Hussein, or he felt he predicted that Saddam Hussein was going to invade Kuwait. And then he was furious when the Saudi Arabians chose the Americans as their partner in fighting Saddam Hussein instead of Osama bin Laden and his fighters, which furthers the thinking that Osama bin Laden was no friend of Saddam Hussein.
I think you're quite right. I mean, there was many murky undertakings in the Middle East and elsewhere. All kinds of people talked to all kinds of other people. But the bedrock of Osama's thinking opposed Saddam Hussein. The Ba'ath regime, for its many sins, was very secular. And one thing Osama never was secular. When he came back in 89, he was feted in Medina, Mecca, Jeddah, by very important and very rich Saudis. And he kept saying, we've got to watch out for Saddam. He's up to no good. Well, the Saudi royal family didn't want to hear that. Put yourself in the shoes of the royal family. They're running a kingdom. That's a difficult job. It's all not sweetness and light. And their most dangerous and threatening neighbor happens to be Saddam Hussein. The last thing they wanted to do was to have some kid who'd been made into a superhero by the press going around bad-mouthing Saddam Hussein in Iraq.
Do you think if you were to meet him, from what you know about him, that you might, that's an odd question, but that you might be charmed by him?
Oh, yeah, I think, sure. Look, I've, in a long life of interviewing bad guys, Osama's more interesting than most. I mean, he's not just a thug. There's another side to him. Any interviewer with his or her salt is at times charmed as well as repelled by contemporary history's larger-than-life villains or good guys. That said, would that stop you from asking the right questions? I hope not.
Just tell me, what is the one question? I know you have many, but what's the one question you want to ask him?
I want to know when he became anti-American, because I don't know that answer. I went to see a Palestinian friend of mine who I knew from Beirut, who was in the Palestinian resistance in the 70s and 80s. He put me onto a childhood friend in Jordan who was an engineer. He had worked for Osama's father, adored his father, just loved him. Old man bin Laden was illiterate, but he had that. He was a great leader of boys and girls. I mean, he had that ability to energize people. And Osama had worked for him, and he'd show up every day at 5 o'clock in the morning. He was very good. He took orders. His job was to go to the government ministries and smooth out the problems. Many of the engineers who were working for the bin Laden group on that job, the bin Laden organization, were Westerners, and many of the Westerners were Americans. Osama got on beautifully with them. He spoke English with them. He spoke perfect English. There was no indication. We're not talking the late 70s and early 80s. There was no indication of this abiding, what became an abiding hatred for all things Western and especially American. Mm. I still do not understand when and how he changed.
When did it turn into such a visceral, murderous hatred? That's what you want to know.
I talked to one person who said that even when Osama was a boy, he had religious instruction from a Sudanese cleric. And that the Sudanese gentleman had told his family, you must be very careful about Osama. There's something quite intolerant about him. But that's the story. The rest of it, you know, he got on, as I say, he got on beautifully with these Westerners. Yeah. And he got on beautifully with a Palestinian engineer who was part of the PFLP. It was a Marxist. So, I mean, go figure.
Well, Jonathan Randall, you have answered most of all the other questions about Osama bin Laden in your new book. Thanks for talking to us about it.
And thank you so much for thinking of me.
Robin Young speaking with Jonathan Randall. His new book, Osama, details the life of Osama bin Laden. Still to come, Russia's National Day of Mourning for the hundreds who died at the hand of terrorists. Also, how cyber sleuths are helping the FBI and CIA in the war on terror. You're listening to Here and Now. An Oreo is more than a cookie. It's also street slang for a person who is black on the outside and white on the inside. Someone who is African American but who acts white. Earlier this summer, comedian Bill Cosby said that black people who study and take school seriously shouldn't be derided by the black community as acting white. Christina Brody is 16 years old and the author of a recent commentary in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution called I Care About School. Does That Make Me an Oreo? Here and Now's Jennifer Westaway spoke with Christina, who explained why she found the term Oreo offensive.
It's a problem because it's a derogatory term. And to anyone who's ever been called an Oreo by another black person or someone, anybody, it really doesn't feel good.
I understand the racial element to it, but there's another element to it that I think children of any race face when they stand out a bit in class, that whole smarty pants, sticking your head above the rest.
Yeah.
Don't you just naturally get teased?
Not so much anymore, but yes, I used to get teased a lot because I was smart, and people do make comments now still about my intelligence, but I just try and brush them off now.
Why is that more of a problem for you than, say, it would be a white girl in middle school getting taunted because she's smart?
Well, I think because of the perception of the black race that we don't pay attention to education and everything, even after our ancestors fought for so long about for our freedom of education, I think that it's not so much of a problem for white students because people see whites as successful and not as many blacks as successful. And when you see a black person on the news, it's more of a black person who's in trouble than someone doing something right.
One of the things that you wrote in your piece, that you said, I'm looking for a place, a school, a university, a community, where being young, gifted, and black works for me and not against me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you live in Silver Spring, which is not that far from Washington, D.C., where, of course, Howard University is.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, aren't there places out there where being young, gifted, and black is absolutely rewarded?
Yes, there are places like that, and I actually just haven't found them yet, or I haven't gotten to that point where I'm old enough to go there. But yes, there are places out there. There are definitely places out there, but just not where I am right now.
Well, I raise it because, of course, you are 16 years old at the moment, and this is something that you faced in your early schooling and might not later. But the point that you want to make is what it does to hopes and dreams.
Yes.
You sounds like you're going to overcome it.
I'll try.
Christina, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Jennifer Westaway speaking with 16-year-old Christina Brody, a high school student in Silver Spring, Maryland. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
To be a young, gifted, and black. Oh, what a lovely, precious dream.
I'm Gail Harris. It's Here and Now. Russia began a period of national mourning today for the men, women, and especially the children who died in the siege of a school in the city of Beslan in southern Russia. The burials began yesterday, and 120 more are scheduled for today. Officials say more than 350 bodies have been retrieved so far, but the final toll is expected to be much higher. Joining us from Moscow is Andrew Jack, correspondent for the Financial Times. Andrew, welcome.
Thank you.
Andrew, one of the things, just for the benefit of people who may not have been listening to all the details over the past couple of days, there does seem to be some evidence now that this was very well planned, very well thought out for a period of months. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, the suggestion from the authorities is that a substantial amount of explosives and weapons were smuggled into the school over the summer when there were some repair works taking on, which seems to suggest at the very least, obviously, some breaches of security. And even some officials have suggested complicity, whether willing or through force, between the hostage takers and the local police.
And Andrew, where you are in Moscow now, how surprising has it been to hear open criticism of the government, even in some of the official newspapers?
Well, it certainly makes a change from the general pattern, which is rather more focused on criticism, perhaps, of local officials or ministers, but not going much higher. I have to say, the majority of the anger and criticism is still focused very much on the hostage takers themselves, obviously, and beyond that, on the local authorities. But certainly now you are starting to get politicians, as well as ordinary Russians, raising questions about the structure of the military and the security services that allowed this to happen. Less so far of President Vladimir Putin himself, but a quite unprecedented wave of criticism that we haven't seen since the sinking of the Kursk submarine back in 2000.
I read in one report over the weekend that historically acts of short-term political terrorism tend to decline when negotiations are going on. And, of course, the Russian government has a tradition of absolutely no negotiations, very hard line. Do you get any sense in the public that perhaps that's not the way to go now?
I think on the whole, again, sadly, the general sentiment in Russian society is a very negative view of Chechen society as a whole. And a widespread reaction here has actually been to support President Putin in continuing to stress this idea of a hardline approach. That has to be taken in the context of a period in the late 90s that Russians remember when Chechnya effectively had independence under Aslan Maskhadov, now a rebel leader. And they remember it as a time of widespread anarchy, killings, criminality, and kidnapping.
Well, as you look at the region, though, how likely is it that this cycle of violence is going to end, or do you think there will be even more in days to come?
I think certainly at the moment one of the biggest concerns is the flashpoint of North Ossetia itself. This is traditionally a fairly calm area of the Caucasus, but it's a predominantly Christian republic. It's sitting next to Ingushetia, which is a predominantly Muslim republic. And the English themselves have been increasingly seen as being drawn into the Chechen conflict. And there's a danger with a lot of extremely angry people on the streets now in North Ossetia wanting revenge, that it could rekindle a civil war that took place between North Ossetia and Ingushetia only just over 12 years ago. More generally, I think certainly there are feelings that there's been a number of rise in violent incidents and political tensions throughout the North Caucasus over the past few months. And at the moment, there's little sign of those abating.
Andrew, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Andrew Jack is a correspondent for the Financial Times. His new book is Inside Putin's Russia. Late last week, a military court in Fort Lewis, Washington, handed down a verdict against Specialist Ryan Anderson, guilty on 5 counts of trying to assist al-Qaeda. Anderson, a 26-year-old tank crewman and Muslim convert, had attempted to pass along information about U.S. troop strength, tactics, and military weaknesses. Instead, he passed it along to the FBI, which arrested him in February. But the agency only learned about Anderson's activities after it had been alerted to them by one Shannon Rossmiller, a small-town Montana judge who spends her spare time trolling the Internet for Islamic extremists and potential terrorists. Judd Rossmiller is part of a little-known group called Seven Seas Global Intelligence. Here and Now guest host Jennifer Westaway spoke last week with the head of Seven Seas Global Intelligence, an unemployed Canadian computer programmer named Brent Astley, and she asked him to explain his group's activities.
Well, basically, we survey the Internet. We check out websites and forums that we know to be frequented by Islamic extremists for the most part, and we get to know the people who habituate these places, and we keep track of them. We determine which of them are the most credible, and in turn, which websites are the most credible, and from them, we quite often derive valid threats.
Who are you? We know that one of you is a judge, and you have another career. Is this a hobby?
Well, we consider it to be, perhaps at the moment, a deadly serious hobby. We've not yet been paid anything for it, so I suppose in that sense we're amateur, but I would claim that in terms of our skills and whatnot, we're most certainly very professional.
And where are you located? Spread all over?
Yes, for the most part, four of us are in the United States. I'm here in Canada. And then we have a member in Singapore and another in Australia.
Well, I gather that the judge in Montana, Shannon Rossmiller, was very much in opposition to your group going overt rather than covert in its operations. Can you be effective now that people know that you exist?
Oh, yes. Yes, they know we exist as a group. But when we're operating in our undercover mode, so to speak, they wouldn't know who we are. And if they did, we'd be in a lot of trouble. So we go to great lengths to make sure that that is not known.
How do you know that the information you're collecting is good intelligence? In other words, is it possible that someone would be on these sites posing as an Al-Qaeda terrorist to land you in some sort of trouble?
Well, sure. And that does happen. There are, you know, I'm sure in various cases we've been chasing FBI people, or they us, perhaps. And, you know, if we're both fairly good at what we're doing, neither of us finds out.
Have you had much success with this? I mean, we do know about the Anderson case.
I would say we've had a great deal of success. We've had a number of operations, or call them what you will, that I would say have been of greater import.
What is it that you're doing that the CIA couldn't do for itself?
Well, I don't necessarily know that they're not. I guess the point is that there are just so many websites out there, and there are so many terrorist supporters, that sort of person out there, that I don't think it's possible for these agencies, even if they were throwing much more money at them, to be able to monitor everything in the depth that we do.
How's your Arabic?
Slim to none. None of us actually speak Arabic. We make do as best we can, and we've been fairly successful using our techniques as we do.
Well, I'm going to have to follow up with a question on that, because, I mean, what are the odds that a cell of Al-Qaeda terrorist is communicating in English?
Some do. Very few, really, though.
But you must be missing a lot if you don't speak Arabic.
We make use of machine translation.
Yeah, I've tried that in Spanish, and the results are sometimes hilarious.
Yes, they are. Unfortunately, a lot of the material we're looking at is very frightening, though, really.
Why do you do this?
I'm trained as a physicist, and physicists are naturally problem solvers, and I see this as a big problem, and I want to do my bit to solve it. It might be, too, I suppose, that maybe this is my war, and I'm fighting it behind my computer instead of on a ship or on a battlefield somewhere.
Brent, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Stay safe.
Thank you.
Brent Astley heads the organization Seven Seas Global Intelligence in Norwood, Ontario.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Gail Harris. Get into your radio and join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.